Thank you so much for coming. My name is John Peters, and I usually do the presentations on this course. I look forward to getting to know you over time. Just to let you know what normally happens, there's food served between 7 and about 20 to 8 or so, and then a kind of welcome, then me droning on for a bit, then coffee, and we take our coffee into small groups, and I'm going to say a little bit about small groups later on, but really, the small group, your small group, is the one you ate with earlier on. And we aim to end each evening by about 9:15, though tonight it will be about 9. So, amazingly, there's actually a totally optional weekend away built into this course. And so you might want to etch this in a very faint pencil in your mind's eye's diary, the 6th to the 8th of March. I just say that because sometimes people want to go on the weekend, and then they find that they can't because they've got to book something else in. So I'm just throwing it out there right now. If you have friends and you think would enjoy this, just feel free to bring them along next week. All the talks are recorded and can be downloaded from our website for free, stmarieslondon.com. Each week I recommend a book relevant to the subject for the week. And this week I'm going to throw out this one. It's Believing in God Irrational, Amy Orr Ewing, started first in theology at Oxford, very intelligent person, and a simple look really at some of the main questions about the existence of God that might be interesting to you. once again, well done for making it over the threshold, not just because it's so cold, but also because many say that arriving here for the first time is the most difficult part of actually doing the whole course. And that's probably because churches, for lots of people, are not very easy places to come into. And especially for those who've had negative experiences of one kind or another. The American president, Abraham Lincoln, once said, "If all the people who fell asleep in church on a Sunday morning were laid out end to end, they'd be a lot more comfortable." In general, the church doesn't really enjoy a good reputation these days. Many think of it as being thoroughly boring, out of touch, judgmental, a place for those who are simple enough to enjoy ancient fairy stories. And I hope that this course will confirm none of those stereotypes, but of course stereotypes exist for a reason. So once again, if you're coming in with any negative preconceived ideas, I admire you for making it through the doors. The theme of this evening, and the whole course is really framed around the question of meaning, but the theme of this evening is the meaning or meanings that we give to our lives. But let's begin with the notion that whatever we find meaningful at a personal level, that we find meaningful, there's actually no overarching meaning to life whatsoever. Chris Evans, TV presenter, said, "Life is about just wandering around, waiting to die, bumping into each other and achieving a few things." And you'll probably recall a few years ago, a group of atheists, including Richard Dawkins, got together to run an advertising campaign. And various buses in London featured their poster. It said this: "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." And this campaign was replicated in many other cities. Now here's an interesting thing. One of the most enthusiastic donors to the campaign was a Christian called Paul Woolley, head of a think tank called Theos. And he was enthusiastic because he thought this would prove to be a great way of encouraging people to actually think about God. He said, "The posters will encourage people to consider the most important question we'll ever face in our lives, which is, does God exist?" Now, it's with this kind of spirit that we run this course. Amongst the justifiable criticisms of the church is that it attempts to get people into their buildings with the sole purpose of either metaphorically or literally shouting at people until they actually believe what the church says they should believe and behave in ways the church thinks are appropriate. And you ever have one of those days? So, we don't think that's appropriate, obviously. What we want to try and create is a non-judgmental, non-confrontational context in which people can discuss questions which are important, the big questions of life, and listen to the ideas of other people as well, without feeling there's a kind of loaded church gun aimed at their head. And when I say big questions, I mean questions like, what is the meaning of life? Is there a God? Is there a purpose to our existence? What happens when we die? That kind of thing. Throughout history, these have been taken to be important questions, of course, and they still are. And I think it is part of the church's role to offer a context in which these questions can be openly discussed, as opposed to the alternative, which tends to be, when we're fairly pissed at the end of a dinner party or in a pub, and we have had a chat and we reach some amazing conclusions about the meaning of life, we just can't remember what they were the next morning. So at the same time, we have found that people are genuinely interested to hear something about Jesus and his teaching and what Christians think as well, even if they don't necessarily know very much about that. Some people obviously have a hazy understanding from their childhood. Others have quite a negative opinion based on the kinds of experiences they've had in church, which are largely the fault of the church. And I've mentioned things like its apparent irrelevance, coldness, impenetrability, that kind of thing. And so as the course progresses, we do try to explain some Christian claims in a clear and approachable way so you can reflect on them and see what you think about those. Towards the end of the course, we consider subjective questions that people often find fascinating. For example, is there such a thing as spiritual experience? Can we experience something above and beyond ourselves? Is belief in God more than an intellectual exercise? What is faith? And is it something that makes a difference in everyday life? That sort of thing. But let's start with the proposition that there is no meaning to life at all. There's no creator, there's no purpose for life upon the earth, there's nothing beyond what we can touch, see and taste, and when we die and that's it. The Bass campaign reflected a robust confidence in atheist ideas, which I think have had something of a renaissance in recent times, and we are going to consider atheism in more detail next week. But for now, I'd just like to draw attention to a couple of things just to get us started. Firstly, the word probably, as in, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. There's probably no God. There's probably no God. Now, the word probably is included partly to satisfy advertising standards. It has to be there, because nobody can say whether there's a God for absolute certain or not. It's unprovable. We can't be certain. We don't know. But for me, probably is a bit problematic. I don't like probably, I like definitely. I don't like my wife probably loves me. I don't like being given food that probably won't kill me. And I certainly wouldn't want to spend £12 going to watch Fast and Furious 6 at the cinema because it'll probably be quite good. It won't be, it'll be crap. And I certainly don't want to base my whole life on a probably. So unless or until that probably disappears, I'm sure you'd agree it's worth exploring the alternatives. Maybe they aren't so uncertain. The second thing to mention is this. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. Now, obviously, that is a very good and noble sentiment. We should stop worrying and enjoy our lives. Absolutely. But if there's one thing that's definitely going to make me worry and therefore not enjoy my life, it's uncertainty. And as we've seen, there's uncertainty surrounding the whole shebang. So how am I supposed to stop worrying and enjoy my life? There's a chance I could be completely wrong. And if I'm completely wrong, I should worry about that. So I'm not sure the second half of the sentence necessarily follows on from the first. But these points aside, if there is no overarching meaning to life, what does enjoying your life look like? Enjoying my life, enjoying my life, enjoying my life. That means to me such things as experiencing as much as I possibly can all the time, especially the things I like, and succeeding in things I'm interested in, that sort of stuff. My friend and colleague Ed, who some of you will have heard speak in the church, tells a literally hilarious story against himself, which I find very gratuitously offensive, and I enjoy telling it against him, even though he's not here. But he talks about a time when he was talking to a very attractive young woman at a party. He admits that he wasn't actually talking to, he was actually overhearing. He was overhearing a very attractive woman at a party at Christmas, while she was talking to her equally attractive female friend. He wasn't really involved. That's the point to grasp. In his mind, though, he was talking to both of them, and they were finding him witty and charming and touching his arm in a kind of flirty way and guffawing and saying things like, "Your wife's so lucky." But in reality, he was just overhearing. Let's just make that clear. And the very attractive number one, girl number one, was saying to very attractive girl number two, "The thing is that I've got loads of money. I'm very successful. I just can't stand the idea of being ordinary. I don't want kids, I don't want a husband, I don't want a house, I want to go to parties. I'm in a different city every month, I sleep with countless beautiful boys, and I take a lot of drugs." Now, what really made Ed think was the expression, "I cannot stand the idea of being ordinary." I don't know about you, but, how would you feel if somebody said, "Oh yeah, they're just quite ordinary"? I mean, it's not what we aspire to in our dream world, is it? On my tombstone, "Oh, John, he was ordinary." We're looking for something more than ordinary, aren't we? And for much of my adult life, I would have pursued all kinds of things because they were new, because they were exciting, because they were interesting, as I'm sure you would as well. And that kind of attitude is still important to me. I want to get as much out of life as I possibly can. And I think there is something very attractive about people who kind of press that to the max, who wholeheartedly go for what they can get from life without fear or inhibition, the pursuit of the experience of life. And the Good of the Party obviously has something of this. It's not just physical experiences, it's emotional, psychological as well, but close, of course, to a determination to immerse oneself in the experience of life is the idea of me seeking my own self-fulfillment, getting everything I can out of life for myself, to be full in and of myself, self-fulfillment, literally. And it can be very attractive. Pete Doherty, Hunter S. Thompson, Amy Winehouse, Courtney Love, these are all people who excite us, they intrigue us. We find people like this deeply alluring. And thousands, fascinated, follow what they do. But is this the fullness of life? Because, of course, there will be a time when the looks deteriorate, the energy wanes, and the pursuit of these things gets too tiring. And all the people have gone home. And what are you left with? Alex James, bass player from Blur, who saw it as his personal responsibility as a rock star to spend as much time drunk and misbehaving as possible, wrote about an episode in his life which occurred during the height of his fame. We left in the morning to find Damien Hirst in Provence. He was playing volleyball. His host was slaughtering a lamb. We went for dinner at the world's most expensive restaurant. From the moment the junior waiter unfolded your napkin for you until the nice lady lit your cigar, things could not have been more tippity-top. Leaving the best hotel in the world with my exalted consul to arrive at the most expensive restaurant in my own aeroplane to meet the world's richest living artist. The next day we flew to Mick Jagger's chateau in the Loire. It was going to go downhill all the way from here, surely. This was the top of the hill. What else could life hold? It's funny, he says, but when I look back, I think that period of my life was the bottom of the pit, rather than the summit of Mount Fantasticus. I was a morally bankrupt, pissed fatso with a stupid grip and a girlfriend with a murdered heart. If there is no overarching meaning to life, other people really don't matter. Who cares? It's meaningless anyway, right? Why should you give a damn? Why should I give a damn? Or, you know, for instance, you're late. It's an important meeting. And there's an old lady going quite slowly across a zebra crossing. I mean, ultimately, if there's no meaning and nobody's around, just go straight over her. It's a bit slow. Now, nobody lives like that, do they? They don't think to themselves, it's a valid option. I mean, in their fantasy world, they might as well, you know, really rev the accelerator and go for it. But in reality, you're not sitting there thinking, oh, that's a valid option for me. Unless we're actually a psychopath. We're not actually thinking that, are we? We do give a damn. And, if we become a bit cynical over time, we probably remember a time we did give a damn. Isn't life supposed to be about more than me? We've surely seen enough of what happens when famous people immerse themselves in themselves to know it doesn't often turn out that well for them in the end. We might envy the wildness and covet the wealth, but this isn't what most people want out of life. Other things beyond the exploration of myself seem to be more important. So, if pressed to define the meaning of their lives, I would like to say most people on the streets right now would say, I want to be a good person and do good. I want to be a good person and do good. So perhaps the meaning of life lies in being and doing good. And we don't need God to exist to attempt to express goodness, do we? One of the iterations of the atheist campaign in the United States read, you don't have to believe in God to be good, for goodness sake, right? So, why can't we just all be good? Wouldn't the world be a wonderful place if we were? If we were, wouldn't we all experience the fullness of life? Surely what the world needs now, love, sweet love, don't you think? A world in which we're full of love and goodness would be great. Intimate relationships are the stuff of which significance is made. After all, no one exists in a vacuum. I'm from your part of the world, from your family. I'm your husband, your father, your lover, your friend. People see themselves revealed in loving, intimate relationships. It's the subject of a million and one pop songs, for good reason. We still believe we should give and receive love, don't we? But it does seem that we're finding it increasingly difficult to do it. Modern life allows us to exist in increasing levels of isolation, or so it seems to me. And we seem to have lived in mutual solitude and settled for that as well. Broken lives can often sort of almost drive us towards further brokenness in our relationships, and that can lead to more brokenness as well. And so the cycle of pain goes on. But what if we do manage to keep our side of the deal? If we're able to give ourselves to someone wholeheartedly, to continually and completely give ourselves to our communities, to the homeless, to the war-torn, to the hungry? What if we manage to be good and do good to others? Can we be sure that we will get anything back? Because some of the kindest, most generous, most altruistic people in the world have been treated like scum by the very people they've given their lives for. But does that matter? Pure love expects nothing in return. It's heroic and it's altruism. That's what makes it so extraordinary and so rare, let me say. But who here could really flourish without receiving love? Is there anybody really who couldn't do with just a bit more love? I mean, I know that it's not acceptable to say, No, that's so true. Because we're pretty strong, aren't we? Strong individual people. But the reality is we all need people that love us. And we suffer when they're not around. That's the reality of the situation. We can give out an incredible amount of love, and this brings with it a sense of fulfillment. But I suggest that there is no one in this room that can do with receiving a bit too. The giving of love is very important, but so too surely the receiving of love. Sadly, again, because of the context in which we live, despite our best efforts, I think both the giving out and receiving of love have become increasingly complex for us. However, some of us, maybe a lot of us, are lucky enough to say we do have loving relationships. Not perfect relationships, obviously, but they're okay. We do good where we can, we have a sense of purpose and excitement of a kind, and enjoy our lives, at least now and again. I mean, there are certain things we have to put up with, but surely everybody does. And yet, why is it that people so often feel a certain something is missing? Why is that? Why is there a sense of restlessness on the inside? Something you can't quite put your finger on, nothing that traumatic, just a sense, and maybe something else. So Heidegger and Schopenhauer described it as boredom, Nietzsche called it seasickness, Sartre called it nausea. The sense that there is something more to life than this, that there is an unease at the heart of things. However good or bad or indifferent our life currently is, there can be an aching for something more, and that is often why people do this course, just so you know, it's often why they do it. And actually sometimes, and this is a painful thing, when we have the first week's discussion, and in my group, I ask people to say, if they wouldn't mind, why they're here, or why you're here, it's not uncommon for people to cry at that point. Because it is the sense of whatever it is so painful that they come in with it, you know, and they haven't got words for it. It's painful. So, it's falling down again. My parents made me go to an Anglican church, Church of England, and they always went to church every Sunday. I don't know that they actually knew what they believed at all, but it was what you did. So it was a socially acceptable thing to do. And it was incredibly dull. It wasn't offensive, unless dullness is offensive. Actually, dullness is offensive to me. It was really offensive. It was offensively dull. But it wasn't, you know, judgmental, because it didn't believe anything. It didn't have the framework to be judgmental towards anyone, because literally the guy that led it didn't believe anything at all. I don't know what he was doing in the job. But whatever it was, he used to involve reading bits from the newspapers in his sermons. And basically, I mean, he was okay. He couldn't remember my name. I found that quite offensive. I was going for a long time. He used to attach it to my brother when he did remember it. Anyway, it just was terrible. The music was appallingly bad. I mean, appallingly bad. And if you have any appreciation for popular music, as I definitely did, I was in a lot of bands, it was disgustingly bad. So, you know, and that was also very offensive. So that was a double strikeout for me. Then I did religious studies O-level. I'm delighted to know O-levels are coming back, because for years I felt bad because people do GCSEs, but now they're coming back, isn't that good? I'm contemporary again. So basically, I did religious studies O-level. What goes around comes around. So basically, religious studies O-level was an exercise in explaining how the life of Jesus didn't mean what it said it did. So, you know, the lives of Jesus recorded in the New Testament, in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they are not what they appear to be. they are sort of code, for, they're symbolic code for basically being a nice person. So obviously Jesus didn't feed 5,000 people from bits of bread and fish, because that's not possible, is it? So what it really means is that he was such a nice guy that people were persuaded to share their food. Or Jesus didn't walk on the water, did he? Obviously people don't walk on water, it's embarrassing. Well, he was paddling in the shallow water, it was in the moonlight, they were a bit confused, the disciples next to him. But obviously he wasn't walking on the water, and so on. And it basically reduced the story of Jesus to the story of, you know, a sort of quite right on, you know, be a nice person, you know, because that's important, isn't it? Be nice. Play nicely in the playground. And so basically I thought, well, this makes a lot of sense, because what it means is Jesus died on the cross, end of story. Obviously there's no resurrection, because there couldn't be Jesus being raised from the dead, because that would be another supernatural thing. Supernatural things don't happen. Ever met a dead man that's been risen? No. How can you believe in dead men rising in an age of electric light bulbs? See? So basically, after a while, I thought, this is a fairy story. I've been sold a fairy story. And it makes sense, because the church was powerless, uninteresting, and offensively dull. So I'm out of there. So, meanwhile, I continued with my experience of my life, which was very much about music, bands, performing. It was about doing well at school, and it was particularly about defining my identity according to whether I was attracted to the opposite sex. Now, that might appear to be odd now, but back then, think Brad Pitt, treble it, that was me. I know. Something like that. So, basically, no, but it wasn't really about me. It was more about, did they find me attractive? And so basically my self-worth was based on that, those things. And everything was going quite well. I graduated from agnosticism to atheism. I studied all the religions, they were all cobblers. Had a go at the occult, nothing. Nothing, not even the devil, nothing. So basically went to Oxford and studied law. And at that point, I was confronted by the fact that life was going to go on. So basically, I tore ligaments in my knee when I was about 17, and I remember asking my parents, why is it that everything I touch turns to gold? Because it felt like everything was going on tickety-boo, it was all fine. The problem was, the finer it got, the more I began to worry about what was happening next. Because I began to think to myself, I can just see all of life carrying on. So you go to Oxford in those days, law firms would come to you, they'd offer you a job in the first year, and so you'd sign up so you could see your whole life going on. First job, first wife, second job, second wife. I can see it all going on ahead of me. That's probably what would have happened. And basically, I wanted to know, is there anything beyond this? Is there anything beyond? So, write songs, perform, come off the stage, come off the hype, write songs, perform. Is that it? What about, I achieved all the things academically. Is that it? So it's like, well, is that it? Because I seem to have done it. And I'm still feeling like shit, to be honest, on the inside. And if I look at myself, there are lots of things about myself I seem to have absolutely no power over. If I compare myself with other people, there is a quality of life amongst the Christians that I had by that stage met that I could not even vaguely approximate to. They had a certain something. There was a girl we atheists used to call the girl with the shining face. Now, she had a luminous quality about her, and there was another girl in college called the poison dwarf. Now, everybody, and I mean everybody, especially me, spent all our time trying to avoid the poison dwarf because she was exactly what it said on the tin. Except the girl with the smiling face, so she spent a lot of time with her. And I used to think, well, it's the explanation is simple. It's because you're a Christian. You're a bit simple. You're trying to be nice, but you don't understand what you're dealing with. Anyway, I had one cup of tea with this girl in which I realised she knew exactly what she was dealing with, and it made no difference. And that kind of altruism was a million miles away from me. A million miles. So I was quite intrigued by them as people. And I think that's enough for now. I'll tell you the end of the story another time. So, briefly, an alternative take on life's meaning, just to think about. The desire to experience and to achieve the pursuit, even fulfillment of goals or ambitions, not a shout, don't like that. Forget that. Let's try this. The desire to drink points to the existence of fluids that can satisfy your thirst. The desire to eat points to the existence of substances that can satisfy your hunger. How weird is it actually to suggest that the lifelong desire to identify myself, to work out who I am, points to the existence of someone who can actually tell you the answer? It's just a thought. I mean, how weird is that? You look at the way we're actually made, there does seem to be around us in one way or another the capacity to answer the question. So, we go on to consider sort of Godly concepts a bit later on in the course. What if the meaning of life existed apart from us? What if it existed above and beyond us? That it wasn't our construct, that it already exists, that we can walk into it, that we can enter into it, discover it for ourselves. Obviously, I do believe that God exists. Bill Bailey, the comedian, put it like this. It's just quite a stretch to think that all of this that we see around us is the result of some solar fluke. It's happened because of some random cosmic ordering and a one in a squillion mathematical equation. It's hard to believe we're just the right distance from the sun for all this wonder to occur. Mercury, nothing. Venus, nothing. Earth, fridge magnets, hummus, Spandau Ballet, anything you want. The thing is, talk of God raises a number of questions like how are you supposed to access or experience God? After all, human history has been dominated by attempts to do this. The Greeks and Romans believed in a pantheon of gods, greater ones, lesser ones, good ones, bad ones, kind ones, angry ones, sexy ones, and one with a trident. And they were to be appeased. But they seemed to act arbitrarily and often destructively. Romans considered their Jewish subjects atheists because of their belief in only one God. The Israelites believed in one God who revealed himself uniquely to them at various points in their history. He chose them and they were his people. Buddhism, a complex set of beliefs and philosophies, essentially says there's no God, but that every human being can achieve a sense of transcendence in nirvana. Hinduism, like Buddhism, is another complex system of beliefs, essentially conceiving of a number of gods, and that all of life is a constant cycle of renewal through reincarnation. Christianity has its roots in Judaism, and is the belief that the one true God has made himself real and personal in Jesus of Nazareth. Islam, by comparison, is the belief that God revealed himself primordially or incompletely through various prophets, such as Moses and Jesus. But in the Quran, the revelation from God to the prophet Muhammad, we've got the final complete disclosure of who God is and what he's like. And all of this can leave people feeling thoroughly confused. Is it here? Is it in these and other religions that we find the way or a way of connecting to God? And of course, in any talk about religion, can we in good conscience ignore the less attractive elements of religious history, the wars, the suppression, the exclusivity? And talk about God also raises questions of proof. How can we know for sure that God exists? Can we know what he's like? And will there come a time when science proves once and for all that there's no room for God, that we have all the answers, and that atheist probably has actually become a definitely? Well, these are some of the issues that we're going to consider over the coming weeks. But for now, as we go into our small groups, let's stick with the basic question. What do you think brings meaning to life? Do you think there's an overarching meaning to life? I want to say one word about small groups and then we're going to get some coffee and go into them. So the small group is your opportunity to say anything you want. There's only one rule, and that's simply to respect the other people doing the course. You can be very rude to the leaders of the groups, fine. But it'd be better to respect each other because we're all there on our own terms, if that's okay. So if somebody says something you think is absolutely mental, you just want to say something like, oh, fascinating. Fascinating. Actually, when I say that, it's my code for you are a moron. Anyway, so basically, you can say anything you want, and there are some people in groups who just like to lead the charge. They have no shame, they have no people reservations of any kind. They're in there with their questions, their ideas, and there are other people who, quite frankly, are never going to do that. They want to sit there and listen. Both are fine. You do what you want to do. You're there on your own terms. It's not a test. It's not like somebody's going to turn around to you and ask you if you can name the first five books of the Bible. Nothing. You're not going to be examined at the end of it, okay? You're there on your own terms. And I would say you will get a lot out of the course if you keep coming. It's surprising how people make really good friendships, how they go on a common journey together, even though they start from very different places. So if I could urge you to do anything, it would be just give it a go. And try to overcome the social depth of not really knowing each other and the awkwardness that's obviously going to be there to start with. But it won't be. And you can bring alcohol, right? So we do bring alcohol ourselves, but you too can bring alcohol. Just bring it. And then you'll feel happy. And then you won't remember what you said at the end. So now, coffee and everything are being served, and then we go into our small groups. Thanks for listening.